This is KRCU's Going Public, and I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. This week, Missouri transferred the state-run health insurance plans of 240,000 low-income people to three companies. It's part of a statewide privatization of Missouri's Medicaid program called Managed Care. Lawmakers have hailed the move as a cost-saving measure, but as St. Louis Public Radio's Jerry Buscarin reports, others say it's happening too fast.
Okay, we may need to clarify this before we get going. What is managed care? From a patient's perspective, it's just another insurance plan. Jorge Rodas shepherds his four school-age sons into the car after their checkups at Kreider Health Center out in Wentzville.
Like big family.
He recently signed the kids up for a Medicaid plan run by WellCare, which has a limited network of doctors that doesn't include their pediatrician. So they started seeing a doctor at Kreider, which is in WellCare's network, and Rodas says so far he has no complaints. Checkups and medicine are covered, and when one of his sons had to see a specialist, that was covered too.
And it worked. The insurance working.
WellCare gets a flat fee from the state of Missouri to cover Rodas's four kids, and when they visit Kreider, WellCare pays the clinic for their care. The alternative would be for the state to pay the clinic directly. That's called fee-for-service. Missouri still does this for seniors and people with disabilities. In 2014, Missouri's managed care companies could only operate in counties along the I-70 corridor. The program expanded to the whole state this week, despite a last-ditch opposition effort by Republican Senator Rob Schaff, a family practice physician from St. Joseph.
Managed care companies, their job is to ration the care, to keep people from getting what they need, and they make money doing that, and they put roadblocks in the way.
An external review of Missouri's program showed that Medicaid enrollees on managed care plans were less likely to stay up to date on medications and more likely to use the emergency room, which is expensive. So Schaff argues it's not better for patients. The Missouri legislature passed the rule to expand managed care in 2015 as part of an appropriations bill. It's going into effect right as legislators face a deadline to pass this year's budget, despite Schaff's repeated calls to delay the implementation.
Basically what they're doing is they're structuring this whole thing to put the gun to the legislators' heads, and it's just really, really dirty.
State legislatures tend to like managed care because they can pay contractors a lump sum per patient and let the insurance companies take on the risk of unexpected health costs. But the actual cost savings have been modest in Missouri, about 1.7%, according to one review. Still, the Missouri legislature decided to move forward and expand where managed care plans are offered. It does not expand coverage to people with higher incomes. On May 1st, the state transferred Medicaid enrollees in 54 counties into plans managed by one of three insurance companies, WellCare, Centene, and United Health Group. This was United's first year offering a Medicaid plan in Missouri, so they held an expo in St. Louis for the hospitals and clinics joining the network. United's challenge in Missouri will be to make sure its network of doctors is big enough for patients who live in rural parts of the state. But Stephanie Tomacek, the plan's marketing director, says United is ready for it.
United Healthcare has actually been in Missouri for over 2 years preparing for this. And they've been diligently seeking out those contracts, and our network is very full, and we've been adding that to our online directory every day.
Medicaid programs appeal to companies like United. On a recent earnings call, company representatives said managed care Medicaid can bring in margins of 3 to 5%. As more states expand the number of people on these plans, these companies will be watching closely. I'm Jerry Buscarin, St. Louis Public Radio.
To hear this story again, visit our website at krcu.org. Senator Claire McCaskill says rural hospitals in the state could be forced to close if the Affordable Care Act is repealed. McCaskill says she's met with leaders of several of Missouri's rural hospitals earlier this year, and many of them say Missouri's failure to expand Medicaid has had a harmful impact on their financial health. KCUR's Dan Margulies recently spoke to McCaskill, a Missouri Democrat, about her concerns.
You recently asked the Government Accountability Office to review the closures of rural hospitals and federal programs aimed at addressing the problem. Why is this of particular concern now?
Well, we have, first, more than 2 million Missourians live in rural areas of our state, and 41% of our state's hospitals are in rural areas. We know that they are under particular stress right now, particularly in states like Missouri that have refused the money that has been offered them for their Medicaid program under the Affordable Care Act. We know that there have been 78 rural hospitals closed, including three in Missouri. We know that 74% of those hospitals were actually in states that refused to accept the Medicaid money that was offered by the federal government back to the federal taxpayers in those states. So I want to make sure that we understand all of the public policy reasons that are contributing to the closures of rural hospitals as the Republicans are trying to revamp the health care delivery in this country. I want to stay very focused on those folks, those 2 million Missourians who their medical care is more difficult to get, it is more expensive, and frankly, just on the economic side, these hospitals, in most instances, are the number one employers in these communities. And their health, the health of these hospitals, is very important to the health of rural Missourians.
So as you just pointed out, Senator, Missouri is one of 19 states that have opted not to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. What effect has that had on rural hospitals in the state?
Well, there's no question that it has had a dramatic impact. Rural hospitals are more dependent on, first of all, Medicare, because the populations tend to skew older, and they're more dependent on Medicaid because many of the people in rural Missouri, because there is no other hospital, they are taking in a lot of the Medicaid patients. And then, frankly, they take in a lot of uninsured because of the gap in Missouri of people who make too much money. They're too poor to get on the exchanges and definitely not poor enough to get on Medicaid. So because the exchanges were designed assuming that states would take the money, take their own tax dollars back to help with health care.
You mentioned earlier that three rural hospitals in Missouri have closed. How many rural hospitals in Missouri are at risk of closure?
Well, I think that they would tell you many of them. 46 of the 50 counties in our state that have above average mortality rates are, in fact, in rural areas. And we know that almost half, over 40% of the state's hospitals are in rural areas. We've now lost hospitals in Farmington, in Osceola, and down in Reynolds County. I talk to hospital leaders all the time, and I particularly have spent time talking to leaders of rural hospitals in places like West Plains and Houston and other small communities across our state. And they are very worried. They're particularly worried if the Republican plan for health care involves even more Medicaid cuts than for a state like Missouri that never expanded, that then would be looking at additional cuts. That is really problematic.
Final question. You're up for re-election next year in a state that Donald Trump carried by more than 18 percentage points. How do you like your chances?
I am very comfortable in the role of underdog. I don't think there's any question that I'm an underdog. But I've been there before, and I think it just means I've got to work even harder to make sure I'm listening carefully, showing respect to all Missourians. One of the things that's been frustrating to me is that some of my friends and, frankly, some of my colleagues from very much more liberal states like California and New York, they have a tendency to talk about people who voted for Donald Trump, you know, in a derisive tone, kind of looking down their nose at them like somehow they're not smart. I couldn't disagree more. I think the people who voted for Donald Trump wanted a disruptive president. They wanted somebody who was really going to shake things up because the system hasn't been working for them. It has been rigged against them. Those people who are working two and three jobs and feel like every year they get further and further behind.
To hear this story again, visit our website at krcu.org. Missouri lawmakers late Thursday night sent the state budget to Governor Eric Greitens. The nearly $28 billion spending plan funnels an extra $45 million towards K-12 schools and an extra $36 million for school buses. But it cuts higher education by nearly 7%, which Thomas Harnish with the American Association of State Colleges and Universities says will lead to steeper tuition and more student debt.
Balancing state budgets on the backs of students and families is not a sustainable, smart, long-term strategy for growing the state's economy.
The budget also does away with in-home care services to about 8,000 elderly and disabled patients. However, the Senate passed a separate bill that will restore that funding and allow elderly renters to keep receiving a housing tax break. That measure now goes to the Missouri House. To hear this story again, visit our website at krcu.org. Up next, KRCU's General Manager Dan Wood speaks with Southeast Missouri State University President Dr. Carlos Vargas about the upcoming changes to the university's commencement ceremony. That and much more after the break.
I'm Ari Shapiro. If you find NPR reliable and comforting, you're not alone. If your old car is a bit less than reliable, well, you're not alone either. Donate your car to us and turn it into the programs you love.
Visit krcu.org and click on support for all the details.
We're back with KRCU's Going Public, and I'm Marissa Ann Lewis Thompson. The countdown to graduation has started, but this year before graduates walk the stage, things will be a little different. KRCU's General Manager Dan Wood spoke with Southeast President Dr. Carlos Vargas in the monthly program focused on Southeast about these changes and more.
There's some changes coming to commencement. Let's speak about that and tell folks what to expect.
Well, historically, what happened is I can tell you that over the last few years, even before I arrived here at Southeast, there were already some concerns about the fact that commencement, a single ceremony, was becoming too large. Mm-hmm. And so the issue, two issues that became very critical was being that it's being held at the Show Me Center. Being so large, it actually had an impact on our ability to evacuate those individuals should some kind of emergency arise.
Safety concerns.
Right. That's safety concerns that we needed to take into consideration. So that was on the one hand. But on the other hand, the length of the ceremony became too large. We were, I believe, in the last year that before I came here, it was over 3 hours or something like that, that commencement ceremony lasted. And truthfully, I think we need to recognize that celebration and that those festivities really are not aimed at having students come here and be kept in their families and in a seat and listen to many of the things we have to say. I think we recognize them, we congratulate them, we celebrate it, but then we need to move on and allow them to go and celebrate with their families, friends, and relatives. So what we decided to do is to split the commencement in two ceremonies. There's one at 10 o'clock that's going to include the College of Liberal Arts and also the candidates for the College of Health and Human Services. That's at 10 o'clock.
Okay.
And then we're going to have another ceremony at 2 o'clock in the afternoon for the College of Business, the College of Education, and the College of Science, Technology, and Agriculture. So those two are going to be, we have separated them in that way to make sure that they are about balance, that they're about the same number of candidates in every case. And then the other thing we're going to do is we have, because of the fact that now we have two ceremonies, one starting at 10 o'clock, it doesn't really give us much time to do anything before that. So what we're doing is we are fitting in between the two ceremonies a recognition for the honor students, for the presidential ambassadors, for those students that obtain a 4.0.
That used to be in the morning, or there was a breakfast or something in the morning,
there was
right?
a brief ceremony in the morning, with these new changes, it just really made it very difficult to do that. The students, of course, enjoy being recognized. And we, I totally value that. It's really more practical concern that we have. And to some degree, we need to consider, too, that, you know, the cost in doing some of these ceremonies, of course, is becoming something that we need to pay attention to, in particular in view of the budget conversation that we just had before.
Well, another thing I noted was that up to now, I guess, graduates could only have four guests, but now they'll be able to have eight, so they'll get to have more people come.
That's right. In considering that some of our students are first-time generation college students, it's very often they want to have more people in their family or relatives or friends attend. And so this is going to allow us to give some extra seats to the students that are graduating. So it's all around, I think it's going to be a good move.
It'll make it for a busy day for you, for sure.
It'll make it for a busy day.
But a fun day, too.
It's absolutely a wonderful day. The institution that I came from and many other institutions are increasingly moving in this direction, because what they want to do, too, is make it not too long, so that the students really don't have to see that as something where they have to sit and again listen to people. That many of us give them the same advice over and over again. And sometimes I've had students come to me and say, "Well, we heard you, so thank you. Let's move on now."
Well, and maybe that hurt attendance up to now. Maybe some students just said, you know, I can't, I'm not going to sit for 3 hours. I'm just not going to come. But maybe that will take care of that issue, too.
That's right. Yes. I actually, even up to now, even in this couple of commencement ceremonies that I've participated in, we've already seen that the number of students that actually leave halfway through the ceremony has significantly decreased, because we really have tried to reduce the length of time.
That's good. So some major changes coming.
Yes, and yes, we're excited about it. And I know change is always a little bit difficult to understand and accept, but I think this is one thing that's going to be good for the university as a whole.
Let's talk a little bit about this upcoming conference. The College of Education is hosting a conference to help teachers in the Southeast region infuse STEM with classroom tech tools to help prepare to educate students on the August 21st eclipse. This sounds very exciting. Can you tell us about this conference?
Well, it's a conference. I guess the title of the conference is Collaborative Regional Education Academy Conference, or CORE, and it's going to take place on June 20 and 21st. And the idea of the conference is to provide teachers an opportunity to infuse technology into the teaching of STEM programs. I think that's a wonderful opportunity, because one of the things that you observe is that oftentimes children, as they are coming up through middle school and high school, mm-hmm. tend to shy away from science. And that's something that we need to work on. And this is a conference that promotes that kind of initiative, which is to work with the teachers, to provide the teachers with tools, with opportunities and ideas to infuse technology into the teaching of science. As we know, science is really an important component of anybody's education. And the better prepared we are in science, the better prepared we are to deal with technological developments that are taking place increasingly faster these days.
Sometimes too fast. It's hard to keep up.
Sometimes too fast. That's right. So as we know, sometimes a planet that used to be known as a planet becomes not a planet because of findings that are taking place. But so when you mention the eclipse, we're very lucky to be in a place on the Earth that is going to be exposed to this eclipse on August 21st of this year, and we are going to be in the zone where there's going to be total darkness for over 2 minutes, I believe. And to have the opportunity to experience an eclipse like that is quite impressive. Now, of course, I wouldn't say it's a once in a lifetime type of experience, because it happens that it's 7 years from now we're going to have another eclipse, and we're also going to be in the dark region for that eclipse. So it's going to be an opportunity to again experience an eclipse here without having to go anyplace else. That is again very, very impressive to be at a place where the daylight all of a sudden disappears for a minute or two is quite significant. I mean, the animals react to that. It's really interesting. Yeah.
That was KRCU's General Manager Dan Wood speaking with Southeast President Dr. Carlos Vargas on the monthly program Focus on Southeast. To hear the stories from today's show, visit krcu.org or find us on iTunes to hear this podcast. I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. Join me every Friday night at 6 and Sundays at 3 for KRCU's Going Public.